Thanks, Nick. Thanks very much indeed, colleagues, for very kindly inviting me and for being here to listen. That sounded a very interesting guy. You know, I wish I could be that interesting. I want to speak a little bit around a kind of general topic. One thing that from the last session kind of really interested me, that one place where California lives on is in Glasgow, actually. One of the places where country and Western music has always been very, very popular is the west coast of Scotland. And it's partly to do with the criminality, the kind of Jesse James kind of aspect of that. And as, if you'll allow me a kind of brief paraphrase of that great Roddy Doyle movie, novel and movie, The Commitments, you know, the Scots, of course, are the Californians of Britain and Europe, and the Glaswegians are the Californians of Scotland, and the East End Glaswegians are the Californians of Glasgow, and the Easter House folk, me, are the Californians of East Glasgow. When I was a wee boy growing up, I really wanted to be a hippie, and I was just a bit too late for all of that stuff. which is a great shame. But I used to walk around Glasgow like a hippie, you know, barefoot, as if I was in Venice Beach, barefoot with big, huge bell bottoms and a t-shirt, and it was pissing down the whole time. We used to go surfing as well, but sadly it was in the rain and not on the beach. Okay, back to the topic. I'll get there eventually. Myth today is a type of speech, wrote Roland Barthes. Although when he wrote that, it wasn't today. That was in 1957. Myth for the Barthes who wrote Mythologie was a language, and most especially it was a language that occluded culture under nature. That was the point of myth. It hid culture under nature. That's to say, myths arose whenever things that were culturally constructed were given the appearance of being essentially entirely natural, and myth therefore became a specific kind of structure of thinking. It was that structure of thinking, myth thinking, that arrested criticism, and it did that by suggesting essentially that reality was some kind of absolute non-contestable sphere, and that our task was simply to live with it. It was fate, as it were. In short, myth says quite simply, this is this. Well, that phrase, this is this, although ostensibly extremely simple and straightforward, is itself an interesting figure of speech. It can be, of course, an example of sententiousness, it can be sententious, but it's also an example of ellipsis, of brachylogia, even of anaphora or antanaklasis. But in my usage of it here, it's another rhetorical trope. It's a quotation. It's a quotation, some of you already have guessed it, from Michael Cimino's 1978 Vietnam movie, The Deer Hunter. And I'm going to show just a brief clip from The Deer Hunter. I'm hoping this is the right one. If it's not, I'll just stop it. And okay, a little bit of introduction here. So you know the movie The Deer Hunter? Everyone knows the movie The Deer Hunter. Yeah? Do I need to explain it to everybody? No? Yeah? Yeah.
I've heard of it, but I've not actually seen it.
So. Okay, so you need to go and see it. This moment in the movie, this is before they all head off to Vietnam, before the big wedding scene, and we go out hunting for a deer. And Michael, played by Robert De Niro, confronts Stan, played by John Cazale, in this little scene. It lasts for about 3 minutes.
And if all I right,
guys, whoever took my boots, I want them back.
I got a boot for you, Stan. Yeah. Right up your ass.
Hey, Mike, let me borrow your spares, huh? Do you have some pen?
No, Stan.
No?
What do you mean, no? That's what I said, no. No means no.
Some fucking friend. You're some fucking friend, you know that?
Gotta learn, Stanley. Every time you come up here, you got your goddamn head up your ass.
Maybe he likes the from up there, huh?
Every time he comes up, he's got no knife, he's got no jacket, he's got no pants, he's got no boots. Or he's got that stupid gun he carries around like John Wayne.
That ain't gonna help you.
Oh, what's that help, Mike? Give him the boots.
No way, I ain't giving him no boots. No more. That's it.
You're a fucking bastard, you know that?
Huh? Stanley, see this? This is this. This ain't something else. This is this. From now on, you're on your own.
I fixed you up a million times. I fixed him up a million times. I don't know how many times I must have fixed him up with girls. and nothing ever happens. Zero. And you know you're trouble my kind. Nobody ever knows what the fuck you're talking about. Huh?
This is this.
What the hell is that supposed to be? This is this. I mean, is that some faggot sounding bullshit or is that some faggot sounding...
Hey, shut up, Stan, will you?
Hey, man, you're out of line.
Watch out with that gun, Stan.
There's times...
Watch out with
you
that
know
gun.
What I think? You know what I think? There's times I swear I think you're a fucking faggot.
Hey, come on, you guys.
Last week he could have had that new red-headed waitress at the ballroom. He could have had it knocked, and look what he did. Look what he fucking did. Nothing. That's why.
Shut up, Stan, huh?
Just shut up. Just shut up. Take Michael's goddamn boots and shut up. Otherwise, I'm going home.
I'm
going
home.
Get off my stuff.
Hey, Stott. I said no. What, are you gonna shoot me? Huh? Here.
Okay, thanks a lot. Get rid of that. That scene there focuses on a particular kind of myth that Michael has in mind. The myth that when you're hunting a deer, it's one shot. And that's a thing that becomes, for those of you who know the movie, that becomes very, very important at the end of the movie, because one shot is what it does turn out to be all about. But crucially, at the center of that is this is this moment, as far as I can see. This is this, this ain't something else, this is this. From now on, you're on your own. And you've got that on the one hand, set against what everybody else in the scene is doing, which is saying, let's be a community, let's not have this myth of the one shot, of the you're on your own, of the this is this. Well, this is this here, at one level, signals the call of a reality, things are as they are. It also, however, via metaphor, because it is a metaphorical moment, it signals the end of metaphor. And thus also of the kind of mythology that Barthes had described some two decades earlier. In many ways, and certainly from the point of view of mythologies, it seems to me this is the most important moment in the entire film. The film is centered on a specific kind of frontier mythology that shapes the United States. And when Mike makes his this is this statement, what he's doing is claiming an access to a reality that is somehow beyond that myth. And yet this fundamental reality, as the film will go on to show, turns out itself to be equally mythic. For present purposes, all I want us to note is that what happens here is that myth, a cultural condition masquerading as nature, is aligned with reality, with some unchanging and natural state of affairs. This is this, and there's nothing more to say. But in the movie, it also represents a turning point in the relation between Michael and the others, especially between Michael and Stan. So that turning point is a moment when this can, and indeed must, become that. So it's a moment when this, in fact, is not this. This is the moment when this becomes other than this. It becomes a moment of change. It's a moment of a change of a relationship, precisely at the moment when it's the assertion of the unchanging nature of the world. And that gives me the crux that I need for this entire presentation. On the one hand, myth here indicates a kind of absolute reality, an eternity, an unchanging state of affairs. The undeniable absoluteness of the real in its bare form. Yet simultaneously, this supposedly incontrovertible or unchangeable reality only appears specifically and precisely at a secular turning point, a moment of crisis that indicates change and that therefore calls into question the unchangeability of reality. So the crux is this. On the one hand, myth is nature, unchanging and eternal, and on the other, myth appears only and precisely because of the necessity of change and crisis, which we can call culture. Okay, so that's the basic crux I want to work with. That's clear as the kind of basic theory. Okay, great. In his 1963 study, Myth and Reality, the great Romanian anthropologist, historian, philosopher Mircea Eliade points out that for the ancient world, mythos meant true story. Myth had, and maybe still has, a very clearly defined relation to truth. A mythic narrative represented things as they are known to be, as it were. Further, for Eliade, myth has a specific relation to temporality. Myth's claims upon truth rested in the fact that myth always narrates something that happens at the beginning of time itself. It goes back to our origins. It always represents the truth of origins, so to speak. It is, as it were, the narrative of origins, and specifically a narrative that explains our own origins as human members of a community in the real and material world. Eliade's argument in that text is that myths typically tell how, through the intervention of some kind of superior beings, our own reality or world came into existence, either in whole or in part. It thus is tied firmly to how things are, to Mike's this is this, as it were. In relation to the last talk, the origins of California lie in the Gold Rush, that'd be one mythic version, in the Beach Boys, be a second version, and so on. You can construct your origin, but there's some superior beings, Brian Wilson, who is, let's be honest, a superior being. Actually, in 1974, when Neil Young was touring his Tonight's the Night album, the Eagles made their first tour of Britain, and they were touring still their first album, which came out a couple of years previously. But because Glasgow was kind of well ahead of the game, because Glasgow knew all of this stuff, they come on stage and Glenn Frey shouts out, "Hi, we're the Eagles from Los Angeles, California." And a whole load of people in the audience shouted out, "No, you're not," because they're not from California. They formed in California, in Los Angeles, but they come from like Texas and, and various other parts of the United States. "No, you're not. So you're not from California." But it's a myth which tells a story of origins from these superior beings. And it's from this reason that myth is always true. It narrates how we established ourselves and explains the preconditions of our lives, beliefs, and even indeed of our very historical being. However, even as myths explain the preconditions governing all of our human possibilities, they're also concerned, therefore, with that specific moment, the moment when we see the eruption of the new, with the bringing about of a specific new state of affairs, that moment of an intervention of superior beings. As Eliade puts it, for every emergent new situation, world already exists, is how he puts it. World already exists. The world was already there, even though its structure was different, though it was not yet our world. Just in passing, he's very like Hannah Arendt in relation to that side issue. These two things, ostensibly contradictory, reiterate the problem to which I tried to draw attention earlier. Myth appears, on the one hand, to reconcile agency, our ability to author something new, with, on the other hand, eternity, or the unchanging nature of this is this. Yet, if myth is also what makes the world our world, then myth is something that allows us a local habitation and a name, as it were. Myth allows us to find an order of things, that's Foucault, to cultivate our present being in a wider ecology or environment. For Eliade, the complication of agency and stability, what we might call habitation, but what I now want to call culture, the complication of agency and stability, let's call it culture, can be explained by our understanding of time and of history as an interplay between what Eliade thought of as secular time on the one hand and sacred time on the other. Myth relates to what he called sacred time, to what happens in illo tempore, in that time, a time, as it were, prior to our moments of secularity, moments prior to our being. Our everyday existence, by contrast, is in this time, hoc tempus. It suggests a flow of history that is irreversible, unrepeatable, chronological, guided by chronos, as it were. Sacred time is different from that. Sacred time is eternal, but this means that its events, therefore, are necessarily iterable. Indeed, they can only be repeated. It's a bit like I'll get rock music and pop music in my head now. It's a bit like David Byrne, from Talking Heads. Heaven is a place where nothing ever happens. And nothing can ever happen in heaven because heaven is a place where eternity reigns. So, you're going to be there forever just singing these same hymn the whole time. Sounds terrible. Singing the same hymn for eternity to God, for God's sake. It would be like Neil Young's Tonight's the Night, It was a terrible album. Don't let me go off on one. So sacred time is this eternal stuff, whereas secular time is the time that you and I live in, the time that's as we're passing even as I speak. Sacred time is guided by Kairos, whereas secular time is guided by Chronos. Frank Kermode makes that distinction between Kairos and Chronos, and he makes it in this way. Chronos, says Frank Kermode in the sense of an ending, Chronos is passing time or waiting time, that which, according to Revelation, shall be no more. And Kairos, by contrast, is the season, a point in time filled with significance, charged with a meaning derived from its relation to the end, to Apocalypse, to the end time. We become aware of myth, according to Iliada, in those moments when we suspend the usual flow of chronological time and enter the realm of the sacred, or the ritual. And this can be achieved through our participation in rituals themselves. And that can be like religious rituals, initiation rites, I don't know if you're a Christian, going to Mass or something like that, and so on. But they can also be what happens when, for example, we engage with art, if we consider art to be something that exists in its own order of temporality, framed, as it were, and cut off from the regular flow of time itself. So this kind of sacred time can be what happens when you walk into a museum and you suspend the usual running of history and you think, ah, I've now entered a different order of time and now I'm going to ignore all that politics, all that history outside. I've become a right-wing bourgeois liberal critic and I'm going to be, as it were, an aestheticist or something like that. I'm going to be an aesthete and I'm going to appreciate the beauty of this regardless of all that stuff. Because in here, I'm going to get eternal truths, in the usual kind of rather banal way that some people talk of those things. So one way of explaining this, I think, might be through an appeal to Walter Benjamin, when he famously criticizes what he called the aestheticization of politics, a specific critical attitude that framed a work of art off from its material and historical emergence as the product of a struggle. And I want to return to that later when I'll address modernity specifically. So the key function of myth for a thinker such as Iliada is that it gives us narratives to live by. It provides exemplary paradigms of a general nature that can then be applied to particular instances, and operates therefore as a series of normative practices governing things like diet or marriage, work or education, art or wisdom. In short, it is what gives significance to otherwise merely passing time. It gives meaning to nature, as it were. And in this respect, especially when it assumes a position of naturalness, myth operates rather like ideology. It shapes our norms as individuals and as society, and that's really what Roland Barthes was after. And he therefore proposes the study of mythologies, as a study in demystification. In turn, that suggests a certain enigmatic status for myth. Myth, in that mode of thinking, relates to mystery, to knowledge, and above all, to initiated knowledge. In short, it relates to the cult. And I want to relate that now more explicitly to culture. I want now to suggest that myth is central to an ideology, indeed, of education, but to one that is focused on education as a cult, on cult value, and on a particular idea of culture, in which culture is construed as a series of unchanging monuments, like the sacred texts of what we used to call a canon, whose meaning is always already finalized. And that view of culture is one that translates culture itself, and with it education, into the commodity forum. So this mode of thinking, this mythological mode of thinking, does have its own politics, and it's a politics which is fundamentalist. I'm going to get to that in a slightly more detail in a moment. Okay, next section. Alongside this version of myth advanced by Iliada, we have also what has been classed as a romantic view of myth, such as we see in the work of people like Joseph Campbell, say. Campbell defined myth as, quote, something that never was, but always is. And by that, he meant to indicate that the myth itself was not necessarily a historical true tale, but that it nonetheless operates as a heuristic device, or at least as a hermeneutic device. That's to say, myth allows us to hypothesize that we operate in a mode of anamnesis. It's as if what we learn is really just what we remember. We have always known the essence of things, and myth is what brings that to light. So it's less a case of this is this, and more a case of 'twas always thus. In this kind of account, what we learn is never new, but it's always a memory of what's always been known but was simply forgotten. And there's a politics to that as well. It reminds me very much when I, as a wee boy coming from Easter House, found myself doing my doctorate in the University of Oxford. I was surrounded by all these people that had done their first degree in the University of Oxford. And, you know, you meet a lot of graduates and you do that kind of thing graduates do. You say, well, what are you reading? And they would always say things like, well, you know, I'm rereading Henry James, or I'm rereading Hardy, or I'm rereading Dickens. I'd go back to my home at night and think, they're rereading Hardy. They're the same age as me. When did they read Hardy? They're rereading Dickens, and they're rereading Post, and they're but really what was behind that was that these people never needed to read things at all. They actually had it already in there. And it was just the when they read the stuff, what I would call for the first time, they were actually just remembering it. It's part of what Bourdieu calls the aristocracy of culture. These were people who never actually had to do anything to read because it was always already there. These were people for whom education is simply an impossibility because they've always already known anything that anybody can say. That's why when you go and give a paper at the University of Oxford, places like the University of Oxford, let's call it a stereotypical place, it's very difficult to stimulate a response because, you know, people, if they showed that they had to respond, it'd be as if they hadn't already thought what you've told them. But they already knew it. This is this. 'Twas always thus. I know that. Or, in the words of Richard Rorty, yeah, yeah. In this, nothing changes, obviously. And that's the politics of it. Nothing will change. Campbell's mythology is something that essentially brings us all into Iliad's sacred time, a time of eternity. Our daily events get their meaning by approximating to the true state of affairs in this, not what was, but what always is. Importantly, however, this view is one that also denies Chronos and thereby circumvents the temporal crux that Iliad had given us. So if we want to ask the question of the place of myth and or fiction in modernity and indeed in modern times, it seems to me that we're also asking what is the relation of myth to history, to a state of affairs where you can actually get things going, as Marx famously wanted to do. This brings me to Hans Blumenberg. When Nick asked me to do this, I thought I better actually do a wee bit of research on myth. So I went back and reread Hans Blumenberg's work on myth, and I kind of wish I hadn't, because it took a week of my life. Blumenberg's work on myth, great monumental text, operates as a critique of the most prevalent views of myth's status and operations. Blumenberg asks a fundamental question regarding all forms of modern thinking. He does this also in his Legitimacy of the Modern Age book. The question was, why, given the advance of science and the scientific method, themselves often identified as markers of modernity, why is it the case, given those advances, that myth has managed to survive? How can myth persist in a modernity that has been characterized precisely as a process of demystification through enlightenment and the progress of reason? Why do we still have myths at all, as we most surely do? The usual enlightenment mode suggests that we've moved always from mythos to logos, from myth to reason, speech, and logic. And yet against that, Romanticism, suspicious of science and its claims for absolute truth, revives myth in various ways. The modern resolution of these and of the conflict between Enlightenment and Romanticism is one whereby we have always retained the power of myth, but we relocate it into the purely aesthetic realm. We say that we still subscribe to myths, but only when we go into the art gallery or when we read books. In short, myth becomes what Ernst Cassirer called a symbolic form. But Blumenberg wants to overcome the opposition between Enlightenment and Romanticism in respect of myth. And here he gives us an interesting new opening, I think. Blumenberg argues that myth emerges because of the conditions in which what he calls man, humans, people, you and me, emerge. Considered anthropologically, he suggests that when we first stood upright, we found ourselves unfit for the environment. Unlike everything else in the world that we were now disrupting by our stance, we had no properly assigned and proper place. In short, we were, quote, without a clearly defined biological niche. And we thus faced what Blumenberg calls the absolutism of reality, what I've been referring to as the this is this moment. This absolutism of reality fundamentally is the realization of our biological fact of the necessity of dying. The existing world, very sadly, is indifferent to us. It couldn't care less about us. And as a consequence, we describe that impersonal world order as a kind of fate or ananke necessity. Humankind, though, as we know from T.S. Eliot, cannot bear too much reality. And as Robert Segal points out, in this situation, anxiety, this is a quotation, anxiety which has no object gets reduced to fear, which does. The impersonal force then gets transformed into animal gods, who in turn become human-like gods. Elvis. Initially, capricious gods become predictable. Initially, indifferent gods become just and then merciful. Initially, implacable gods become appeasable through rituals and ethics. Well, faced with this predicament of our biological arbitrariness, we now therefore produce cults and cultures, cultural and symbolic forms that respond fundamentally to a biopolitical condition. And myth here becomes a response to the problem that we can never be free of our biological origins. In short, we have myth because we are mortal, because we live in a specific kind of temporality that entails our death, our demise, the end of things for worse. For us, worse, this end is also something that ignores us because the world continues perfectly well without us. That's to say, myth responds to the fact of our existential contingency. And what we have as a result of that is culture and education, both of which are designed to try to counter that sense of our own existential contingency, to make us feel important, simply. The understanding of myth's function here differs from that advanced by Iliade. As Segal puts it, myth here is describing the significance of phenomena and not their origin. And in doing this, the theory retains the temporal predicament given to us by Iliade. At the beginning, myth is once eternal and also indicative of change. But in doing so, it focuses on the relation of myth to death, to endings. And it further allows the argument that it's through this that we have myth as cult, or myth, the myth of culture. Okay. Have I got another 5:10?
Yeah.
All right. Easy peasy. Is that okay?
Sure.
Yeah? All right. I might go back and give you some paragraphs that I've cut out then. Because some are really good. Some are really good. I'm just giving you the cutoffs, as it were. Okay, how long have I got, Doc?
We've got 50 minutes in total, so yours and questions.
All right, bravo. Maybe I'm talking too fast. Okay, Frank Kermode, I'm going to go back to him. When he makes his book, The Sense of an Ending. And the lectures that he gave there in The Sense of an Ending focus on how narratives are always shaped by a certain apocalyptic structure. We are always hypothesizing the ends of the narrative in order to make sense of the here and now. You know, when you're reading a novel, I mean, the classic example, of course, is the detective novel. You're always hypothesizing the solution to the crime in order to make sense of the bit of the story that you're at here and now. And that becomes paradigmatic, I think, of all forms of narrative. We always hypothesize the end of the narrative in order to make the sense of the here and now. At the core of the study, though, is The Sense of an Ending. He attends to a very particular and important observation. He says there's a huge difference between myths and fictions. They operate very, very differently. The end that we project, he says, in every here and now, is always of necessity provisional. I mean, you know this from reading your detective novels, because, you know, you propose the butler did it, and then 2 pages later, no, it was the doctor that did it in the library with a gun, and, you know, and so on. You're always kind of changing things. Of course, you never believe that you were wrong. You always move, it's like the Catholic Church, you move from one state of certainty to another state of certainty with no moment of doubt in between. You know, it's dogmatic. And yet, at the same time, you're always of necessity accepting the provisionality of where you stand. The here and now is always subject to change in the light of future information. Well, fictions, according to Kermode, accept this provisionality, but myths do not. The key difference between myth and fiction, for Kermode, lies in the fact that a myth is actually just a fiction that has forgotten its provisional status, and thereby it makes a major claim upon the absoluteness of reality. Here's the quotation from Kermode. We have to distinguish, he says, between myths and fictions. Fictions can degenerate into myths whenever they're not consciously held to be fictive. In this sense, he says, antisemitism is a degenerate fiction, a myth, and Lear, King Lear, is a fiction. Myth operates within the diagrams of ritual, which presupposes total and adequate explanations of things as they are and were. It's a sequence of radically unchangeable gestures. Fictions, by contrast, are for finding things out, and they change as the needs of sense-making change. Myths call for absolute, fictions for conditional assent. So myths call for absolute assent, fictions for conditional assent. it is a bit like the Catholic Church, which is a myth, you know, in the sense that it doesn't believe in the possibility of having a doubt in the, you know, famously, when Vatican II was being worked out, a cardinal was interviewed and gave the response that I've just given you as a kind of satirical response, you know, what's the church's position on such and such, to which the response was, well, you know, we will find out. And that, the interviewer then says, so, you know, does that mean the church is now in a state of doubt? To which the response was, and I quote, no, the Catholic Church is never in a state of doubt. It moves from one state of certainty to another state of certainty. That is myth, according to Frank Kermode here. Our problem today, it seems to me, is that we've not escaped from myth-making, and more importantly, we haven't escaped from mythic thinking. In fact, we exist in a cultural apparatus that increasingly calls upon myth for its validation. And I want, in what's going to be my concluding remarks, to elaborate quite briefly on this as a matter for, that might be for future further debate. If we take Kermode's distinction between myth and fiction seriously, I think we can see that we live in and through cultures that are suspicious of provisionality. This is something I was dying to intervene at the end of the last session because it's something that came up at the end of the last session. It seems to me this is entirely understandable. In precarious times, people might reasonably seek assurance and certainty. And that, of course, is one of the stories behind the origin of the English novel, at least. The English, Gabriel Yospovici, I think, who made this argument, that the novel grows out of a mixture of Protestantism on the one hand and paranoia on the other. And, you know, it's because we're living in a very precarious world when the English novel gets itself going. Nobody really has any kind of certainties anymore. We're beginning to doubt all the kind of institutions that give us absolute truth. And with that, you get a state of affairs where, on the one hand, you're thinking, well, God, where do I stand? And on the other, you know, and you're in that kind of Protestant mode of asking questions the whole time, while at the same time being crippled by anxiety that maybe things are not going to work out right. So the result of this is that you become paranoid, and what you get is a state of affairs where you begin to read signs of your own redemption, your own saving, as it were, by God in nature. So suddenly nature becomes full of significant things. That tree is no longer just a tree. It's speaking to me. It's a sign from God that says I am saved. And then when the branch from the tree falls and hits you on the head, you say, well, actually, no, it wasn't that. It's the river that's the assurance. You know, and you give some significance to the river. And this, says Yospovici, I think, gives you the novel, where suddenly everything becomes significant. Everything becomes non-contingent. The whole world talks to you in such a way that you're driven to make sense of it by searching for absolute certainty. In particular, what you're looking for is a certainty to the answer, a certain answer to the question, am I damned or am I saved? And that's I think, what we get now. So people, I think, might reasonably seek assurance and uncertainty in moments of precariousness. But the result of this, I think, is all too apparent for us in world affairs, and also in the aesthetic realm today. We're witness to all kinds of fundamentalism, be it Christian fundamentalism, Islamic fundamentalism, and even within these, the debates become profoundly sectarian or cult-based. Are you Shia? Are you Sunni? And there is no possibility of a resolution between that. It's a bit like a revisiting of the 30 Years' War between Catholics and Protestants. You know, it's the same. There is no possibility of there being a shared ground here in these cult-based forums. In short, we find ourselves giving up on fictions and replacing them with myths, with Kermode's fictions that have forgotten their fictionality. In aesthetic terms, we face similar issues, usually around various forms of dogma, and sometimes those forms of dogma are called theories. So you have, as it were, your theoretical position, which will not be disturbed by any fact. And that's, you know, the facts are kind of what you ignore. This is the argument that we all know as Paul de Man's argument, the resistance to theory, where he says the greatest resistance to theory comes from within theory, where, you know, and it's a bit like, another Andrew, Colin McCabe famously gave a tremendous paper analyzing American graffiti. And at the end of the, he talked about the great tracking shot at the end of the film. And this brilliant thing, demonstrating all sorts of things about Lacanian suture and all, you know, just extraordinarily deeply theoretical. And a person in the audience said, well, that's all very good, Professor McCabe, but you described that as a tracking shot. It's not. It's a panning shot. And there's a deathly hush. And he says, well, according to the inexorable logic of my theory, that fact is impossible. Which is how he got himself out. But that's actually how it works, is it not? You know, if one is, as it were, committed to a theoretical predisposition, then those theories become myth for us. And for us, I think, therefore, the question is whether myth lives on and how. In a brief piece made in 1932 called Oedipus or Rational Myth, Walter Benjamin cites André Gide. Gide, who argued that, quote, it is reason above all, and reason alone, to which every myth turns. No myth has been understood unless it has been accepted by reason. And Benjamin glosses this to mean that, quote, what is important is how the modern meaning gains a distance from the old, and how that distance from the old interpretation is just a new closeness to the myth itself, from which the modern meaning inexhaustibly offers itself up for renewed discovery. That piece, Oedipus or Rational Myth, begins from an examination of Hamlet in Tales, which is one of the first presentations of Shakespeare in modern dress. And you know, this was very controversial in the early 1930s, to do Shakespeare in modern dress. And the argument that Benjamin was saying was fundamentally, we're getting here in modern dress the revitalization of a myth that was always there. But what's important is how the modern meaning gains a distance from the old, and how that distance from the old interpretation is in fact just a new closeness to the myth. So what this proposes is a kind of ur-myth, a myth beyond the origin that we're still seeking. And at the same time, in classic Benjaminian mode, on the one hand is looking for that kind of sacred time where everything is, as it were, mystically eternal, while at the same time trying to get history started as a site of change and of mutability. So in the light of that, my final question to you, to the conference, is simple. How reasonable is our current view of culture and of education? That view is one that sees culture and knowledge itself precisely in terms of commodities. In terms, then, this is this. Here is the truth, unchanging and eternal, of all culture. Further, this has been presented to us as reasoned and rational. Education is an investment in which, by buying those truths that are universally acknowledged, thank you, Jane Austen, certain investors will get a return in personal gain, personal and individual profit, thank you, Jane Austen. It's the same thing. That's why it's a truth universally acknowledged. You know, that's that opening sentence, I think, captures everything I'm trying to say here. Well, can we reason against this prevailing ideology? I mean, the prevailing ideology, you know, is something that is permeating contemporary culture, contemporary politics, rather, not just in this jurisdiction, but more or less worldwide, where we're getting a kind of revisiting of an extraordinary right-wing ideology that says, this is this, and will not brook the possibility of any kind of dialogue or debate. Can we, and not only that, it's now politicised in terms of it's monetized. Can we reason against this? It seems to me that we must reason against this. But the task must be the difficult one in which we make our claims, and that we make our claims on reasonable and rational grounds, but that reason itself here cannot be an arbiter of final solutions. We're in the precarious position of advocating, and I think we must do this, advocating uncertainty. In the tertiary sector of education, where we find ourselves today, this means that we're in the position of saying that we do not know things as they are. To go back to that clip from the movie, we need to be on the side of Stanley, the guy who is saying, lend me the boots, the guy who in the end says, what are you going to do, are you going to shoot me? And who says, and he mixes all of his kind of comments, as it were, in the interest of trying to get a kind of sense of community. But it's a community that's based upon not knowing things, on not being able to do the one shot, not having the safe target. It's that kind of uncertainty that is always out of your proper moment. It is, as it were, to go back to kind of rhetorical terms and indeed to Aristotle's Poetics, it is living in what Aristotle thought of as the hamartia, that missing of the mark, hamartia is the phrase that always gets translated as the tragic flaw, the flaw of character. A flaw, the word flaw comes from the, or is a translation of hamartia, which in the ancient Greek is a term taken from archery, and hamartia is what happens when the arrow doesn't hit the target. Oh, that's a hamartia, they say, you know, when the arrow falls short of the target, and you didn't hit the target. So it's completely the opposite of the one shot. It's not being in the proper time, not being in the proper place. It is, if I may go back to my opening anecdote, it is being a 12-year-old hippie in Glasgow in 1978, or 77, whenever it was, I was 12, something like that. Let me turn... Finally, how many finals have I had here? Finally, I think. No, I've just seen another one. Don't worry, I'll fizzle out spectacularly in a moment. Not quite finally, let me turn to Walter Benjamin. No, I've read that paragraph. Okay, right, this is finally. So, yeah, this is finally. For Benjamin, I think, myth can be tied to modernity itself, to what he would later call the Jetztzeit, that messianic now time, the time of the now. In fact, I think we might even say that myth explains the now time. And that, I think, is quite close to Iliada, where I kind of began this. Myth is what erupts into the present moment, or myth is what happens, if you like, when sacred time makes its presence felt in the now, in the flow of secularity. But what I want to do to slightly change that now is to say that myth, I think following the inexorable logic of the theory here, myth is what allows the now time to emerge for the first time. But it emerges precisely as a moment of change that rehearses a past. It pretends, in the French sense, prétend, it aspires to offer a new time, a new start for history. But precisely because it is myth, it essentially reenacts the past. And the task for us, especially in the realm of cults, culture, and education, it seems to me, is to do what Marx famously asked us to do, which is not to analyze history, but to try to get history started. The problem for Marx, as we all remember, was not that we were heading inexorably towards the end time of the dictatorship of the proletariat. The problem was that we hadn't managed to get history started that would eventually take us there, because we were living fundamentally in myth. It's extremely difficult, I think, to enter the realm of history at all, in fact. It's difficult to give a substance to the now time that would make of the now or present moment a moment of substantive historical change. In short, it's difficult to make oneself modern if, by the word modern, we mean effecting a transition from how things are, this is this, to how things can become, this is different. In short, therefore, we need to find a mode of critique that eschews mythology entirely in favour of history. And for this, I think we need fictions, but above all, we need fictions and not myths of modernity itself. And I will stop on that. Thanks for your kind attention.